Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Mark Klobis, your host for the channel. Today, we're talking with Susanna Forrest about her new book, The Age of the Horse, An Equine Journey Through Human History. Susanna, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be with you.
We're delighted to have you. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Mark Klobis, your host for the channel. Today, we're talking with Susanna Forrest about her new book, The Age of the Horse, An Equine Journey Through Human History. Susanna, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be with you.
We're delighted to have you. I wonder if you could start us off by telling us something about yourself.
I'm a British writer. I live in Berlin. I've been here for the last 11 years, and I've produced two books about horses and history, but they also sort of bring in ideas of what's going on now and sometimes a little bit of memoir or travel, and sometimes I also convert parts of them into sort of academic pieces. But I love to research and I love to write as well, so I try and do something that brings these things together.
What led you to write this particular book, which is a very broad-ranging overview of the history of the horse in human society?
Well, I basically, the first book that I wrote, I was horse mad when I was a little girl, like a lot of women. And the first book I wrote was called If Wishes Were Horses, and it was a kind of cultural history of horse crazy girls and the way people have tried to sort of pathologize them, you know, work out the roots of this problem that girls seem to have. And I had a break from horses before doing the book, and I just discovered so many stories that were so interesting when I was working on it that it was just completely natural to go on to the next book. And it's based on really striking contemporary stories that I found, and then sort of trying to find the history behind those things and finding echoes that come up again and again in history.
That's one of the things that comes across from the very first page in your book, which is just how far back in history we can trace the humanity's interrelationship with horses. So I was wondering if you could explain what it was you discovered in terms of that intertwining and how that shaped both the development of humanity and the evolution and domestication of the horses.
Well, I think if I'd written the book and sort of paced it according to how humans have interacted with horses, then I think like about 95% of it would have been about humans eating horses. So that was largely what we did with horses. We ate them, we painted them. We presumably used what was left for tools and clothing. And then basically about 5,500 years ago, this is where the current research thinks it is, the horse seems to have been domesticated in Kazakhstan. It could have been somewhere else earlier, but this is what we know. They were milking horses. These are people who are now called the Botai. They were eating them, and they were using every last part of them to build houses as tools and as sort of leather and harnesses and goods. And pretty much there's just such incredible research going on now with horse genes and understanding the genetics of domestication that we can see quite soon the horses begin to change over the next few thousand years before they turn up in the Middle East and really start to expand across Europe and Asia. They get sort of stronger, they get longer legged, they produce more milk, not surprisingly, because that was also what we were using them for. And they start, I think there's some estimates that they sort of changed mentally somewhat, or maybe that the particular wild horses that we domesticated were better set up for doing that. And they also sort of, what surprised me is that they kind of come out in all kinds of glorious new colors, which I hadn't realized was part of the domestication process. So you get spotted horses on and sort of exotic pintos and sort of cloudy colored horses and all kinds of things. But it's about the Bronze Age and the Iron Age. They come together almost with metal and with this sort of increasingly centralized society in the Middle East as well. And they really start to make a difference in terms of politics and war, I think. But really, I think they're just used in so many ways that it's quite difficult to sort of sum up the impact they've had, because we really do use them from everything from, like I said, from making buttons to, you know, sort of symbols of royal power. And so it's quite difficult to hone it down.
And I like how you break it down in the book in your separate chapters. But one of the most fascinating parts of the book was what you describe as the quest to find truly wild horses still surviving, because we oftentimes in America look at Mustangs and we think of them as wild horses. And yet, as you explain, those are actually domesticated variations that have, you know, escaped out into the wild and continued on. The truly wild horses, mm-hmm. who have never really come from these domesticated lines, are in a sense non-existent nowadays.
Yeah, I mean, it's actually quite a shock to realize horses actually went extinct in the wild in the 1960s, probably. So we do still have some of these wild horses, but we only have them because Europeans went pretty aggressively into the steppe at the end of the 19th century and early 20th century and captured, you know, 50 or so foals at a time from these wild horses, which was probably disastrous for the actual wild population. And they then sort of kept them in zoos and safari parks and so on. And now they had a difficulty breeding them because a lot of them were actually related to each other because they got them from the same herds. And then they were sort of nearly wiped out by the Second World War, and things were complicated by the Cold War. And now we have about 2,000 of these real wild horses left, and they're all descended from 13 horses now, which is sort of post-World War II. So they're quite miraculous. They're called either the Mongolian name, which I can't pronounce properly, is Taki, which I think means spirit horse. And they're better known in the West as Chevalsky horses, after a Polish-Russian explorer who was didn't actually see a live horse, but in the 19th century he was journeying across the steppe into deeper Central Asia, and he was given a skin and a skull, I think, of one of these horses, and for that the whole type was named after him. But they're pretty extraordinary. They look exactly like the horses you see on cave walls in Lascaux, and they're genetically different to horses. They have domestic horses, they have a different number of chromosomes. And I kind of got interested in their story and how their story comes together with the way people in the West invented this idea of a wild horse. You look at early accounts of wild horses, and they're just kind of like something you eat or something that gets in the way and eats your crops or chases your domestic horses around, and it's a problem. And then in the age of really sort of from the Enlightenment onwards, they become interesting as scientific specimens because people are starting to think about evolution and earlier versions and taxonomy and making these lists. And then they become with, I think actually almost with Byron, the idea of the wild horse as this sort of romantic sort of noble savage of the horse world starts to blossom. And then people get really interested in wild horses and they're kind of everywhere. And that's obviously helped in the preservation of, in the protection of animals like mustangs, as well as with these the genuine wild horses, the tacky.
It's fascinating how that the way that inverse ratio worked is that as they wild horses were disappearing, our interest in them was growing. And you describe these fascinating preservation efforts by this one Russian, the efforts by the German brothers during the war, and it kind of gets to that theme of your book, which is how they even horses in the wild have this very connected relationship with humans that defines their existence. And with and it's not just in terms of what we've done to effectively eliminate the wild horse population, but also the fact that we then also undertake very as you describe, strenuous efforts to try to preserve it.
Yeah, and to return them to the place in the world where they were last wild, which actually some horses just went out today. I just saw some footage of Shabalsky horses going from Europe and being released in the Gobi, which is the last place they ended up. My sort of nut, as it were, my nut graph for the book was that humans have put huge amounts of energy into sort of inventing and reinventing the horse in all these different ways, and horses have kind of just gone on trying to be horses despite that. I don't know what they make of us. It's kind of a mystery to me. I did try and sort of get to that later in the book. But it's extraordinary, the inventiveness of humans, not just with horses' bodies. We turn them into everything from miniature horses to Belgian drafts, like absolutely enormous animals, to just the sheer number of symbols we've made out of them, and then the practical uses as well. So I love history, and I trained as an anthropologist, and anthropology is kind of a greedy subject. You get interested in economics and culture and symbolism and politics and structure and history as well, and geography, and the horses, it's a really good way to look at a huge number of things and sort of stick your fork in a lot of pies, if that makes sense. And it did feel like doing sort of six PhDs on top of each other, this one, I have to say.
And yet the scope of it, I think, really is the best way of conveying just how wide-ranging that relationship has been. You talk in later in the book about culture and the, as you were just referring to, the how we've represented horses, how they've become symbols of spirit or of power. But then there's the practical application of them that they literally become a measure of power. Although, as you point out, it's one that we've miscalculated. Although I found it interesting,
we miscalculated horsepower. Yeah,
but it's almost like the way we miscalculated it, erred on the side of the horse. It was like we gave the horse greater credit for power than unfortunately was the case.
Yeah, and people were genuinely puzzled when they realized that we were phasing out horses, when we'd finally got all these different pieces of technology assembled to take over from the horse. People were really quite confused, and they put things, they talked about car stables and sort of worried about, we've got these new electric trams, but aren't they going to scare the horses? And, wouldn't it be better to have an accident with a horse and cart than to have an accident with a car? And, they really can't, it takes people, some people are enthusiastic futurists saying, well, great, let's get rid of horses. But a lot of them are really kind of quite bereft and sort of not really sure what to do. It's not surprising when you realize, you know, how much we were dependent on the horse. But it's quite funny almost to read. People just a few years before, you know, it all really tapers off are still thinking in terms of horses and where to keep them and what to feed them and so on. And manure, they were worrying a lot about there was going to be manure up to the third story in New York by a certain period as well. They were quite worried that that was going to happen.
Well, that was one of my favorite parts of your book, which was your description of that interrelationship between horses and industrial technology in London in the 19th and 20th centuries. Because it's not a question or a story of sudden changeover that they invented the steam engine and all the horses were then were now made redundant. It was more the fact that as technology became applied, they still found need for the horses in other ways. And in part, I think it's to just how useful humans had made horses throughout the society of the most urbanized, industrialized city in the world at that time. And how, but you also get into how complex the relationship was that oftentimes they held onto these horses, not because they loved them necessarily. And you describe just how cruel people could be towards the horses they depended upon. But just the recognition that they still served so many roles, even into the middle of the 20th century, for which the technology that we were developing simply wasn't sufficient to replace.
Yeah, and it's also, there'll be factors like, I think, in the 1930s, it became, you know, there were companies that had given up using horses for sort of short-haul transport and then went back to them. You know, they put the motor cars and the trucks away because it was cheaper, and because at that time there was still a skilled labor force that knew how to work with horses. But it took a long time, and still a lot of people, I mean, I spent time with farmers working in the US now who are sort of organic and smaller scale farmers, but who basically say horses are a lot more efficient under a certain, I can't remember, it's about something like 72 or 70 hectares of farming. Like, under that, it's more efficient to have horses. And if you start to calculate in terms of sustainability and renewable energy sources, then, and actually even making money from the horse itself, then horses win over tractors. One farmer pointed out that, you know, he swapped his tractors for a horse team, and sort of over 10 years or something, of course, the horses had foals, which he sold. And so that was tens of thousands of dollars of profit, whereas if he'd bought a tractor, all it would have done is, you know, depreciate, and then he would have had to sell it if possible and then buy another expensive tractor. So it was immediately a loss. But there are some interesting studies being done, sort of comparison on the smaller scale farming, and just, you know, horses, they grow their own fuel. You don't have to transport the fuel long distances, and then they, their emissions help grow more fuel. So they make quite a good, ecological circuit. Although they do require more manpower than tractors, it's true. But, so that was interesting to see. People are seeing horses as kind of eco tools now, which is like an extension of the way they were seen in the 19th century, I think.
In a sense, as agriculture began to embrace economies of scale, that was the only thing that made horses no longer as useful in farming. But as what you're saying then is that as people have reconsidered that, the horse has once again become valued as an asset by farmers.
Yeah, and that's been possible in America because of the Amish, because the Amish have improved the horse-related technology and they've kept the horses going. In the UK, all of our heavy horse breeds, the really big draft breeds, all endangered now. There's one of them is actually rarer than pandas. But you also need to remember that in the developing world as a whole, there's still, 95% of donkeys and 60% of horses are working animals in the developing world. And some estimates say, each of those can support a family of up to 20 people or, contribute to that family. So we're not really past the age of the horse. It's kind of still ongoing. But I thought it was interesting that people in the West are, to some extent, going back to horses, also for stuff like logging and like laying internet cables in remote areas. They're still much better at doing that than the nearest available tractor. So, yeah.
And horses, in a sense, will never go away because, as you describe in another chapter, there are still many societies which value the consumption of horse meat. In some places in the West, horse meat has a certain stigma. It's regarded as not desirable meat or offensive to consume horses. But in a lot of places, not just in what we might dismiss as the third world, but in many Western countries, there is a great value still to horses as livestock, for lack of a better word.
It depends which countries you mean, because in places like France, I think the consumption's kind of falling. It's what I wanted to sort of talk about in the book a little bit is like the history of horse meat in the West, because we basically, the taboo comes in kind of in the Middle East, really in sort of pre-biblical times, probably because horses are expensive. And then that's reinforced by the Catholic Church, who saw it to some extent as a pagan practice, because, all these pagans they were trying to conquer probably descended from these people of the steppes, and they were interested in sacrificing horses and getting up to all kinds of mischief. And then it was not really until the 19th century, till the Napoleonic Wars, that Europe starts to eat horses openly. And begins to legalize it. So, and there was a lot of opposition in some countries to that, not in others. So in historical terms, it doesn't seem hugely surprising that in some places the consumption is falling away. But it's a strange business, horse meat, to put it mildly, to a large part because horses aren't necessarily raised for meat, which makes it complicated for food hygiene. And it gets into a complicated argument. This is one of the reasons people started eating them in the 19th century was it was thought it would be better for horses because otherwise they were sort of basically worked to death. And they thought, well, they'll be looked after if they're going for meat. But then you're kind of telling your customers that they get to eat injured horse or old diseased horse, which is not hugely appealing. And I think there's still some degree of legacy of that in a lot of countries. But it is an odd business. I mean, there are stories now of horses being shipped from Canada live to Japan for meat in Japan. And there's always also this pattern of countries like, Britain and America and Australia that don't eat horses, but are really pretty happy to ship their horses to other people to eat, which isn't great for the horses either. It's such a complicated issue. It raises really high passions. But it's also, we had this scandal in 2013 in Europe when it basically turned out that, in a repeat of a scandal that really comes up all the time, you start to realize when you look at horse history, some unscrupulous dealers had been putting horse meat into cheap beef products. And it wasn't that horse meat had a huge value in Europe. It was that it was very cheap and it looked like beef. So it was going into all these sort of TV dinners and cheap burgers. And it turned out to be happening right the way across the continent. And I just remember one of the spokespeople for a supermarket and their frozen lasagnas had been found to have horse meat in it. And he reassured the public by saying, well, don't worry, actually, our lasagna was only 2% meat anyway. So it was really, yeah, it wasn't that there's like huge value for horse meat. It's that it can be cheap and it does look a lot like beef. But in other places, people have told me it is a delicacy, but it's a really muddled and inconsistent industry, and it gets kind of dragged along in the wake of beef, to be honest, which I think is one reason it will never take off in America, because beef is very cheap. And historically, Americans only eat horse when they can't get beef. So,
but of course, even in America, in places like America, where humans don't consume beef, we still have often taken horses and used them to provide meat for other animals, such as dogs. And you describe how that developed and how that in some places is still going on as well.
Kennel ration in the 1920s, yeah, in Rockford, Illinois, was this huge, I think it was the first canned pet food place. And Philip Chappell, who set it up, was really, I mean, this is the time when horses are beginning to get obsolete. And so he had a ready supply, and he also had access to not only Mustangs, but what seemed to be referred to as range horses, which were, people were raising horses kind of almost wild in the West to supply markets for horses to work in the city or on farms. And of course, they just get in the way of beef after a while, which is exactly the issue that's going on now with the Mustangs. So people suggest putting them in cans, which is what happened in the 1890s. And yeah, with this pet food issue, which attracted what I'm wondering if it's like the first piece of animal rights direct action, or which was an arson attack by repeated attempts at arson attacks by a cowboy called Frank Litz, who was just appalled by the fact that horses were going through this system. He didn't manage to destroy it, but was arrested and locked up. And then as soon as he got out, he immediately tried to blow the plant up again, which failed. It's like I say, when I got interested in the horse meat issue, I knew it was a thorny and a difficult one in America, but I had no idea quite how odd the history was. It's all caught up in presidential elections. It's caught up in a terrorist campaign in the 1990s. It's really, I tried to sort of put it in the history of America and meat in general. And I still ended up taking about 10,000 words out of that chapter because there was just so much material. Oh, and the mafia too, they're involved as well. It just sort of goes on and on and on.
Well, as you explained in your own personal travels in researching the book, how you recount going to an auction where horses are being auctioned off, and it's a visible part of this rather shadowy pipeline where horses are auctioned off and then oftentimes just go somewhere.
Yeah. I mean, the thing with it is that there's no independent oversight for these auctions. I think generally other meat industries are very highly regulated. And because the end product in this case isn't staying in America, there's almost no oversight, which when, the current administration is talking about starting up Sorda again, I'm kind of thinking, but there's no way they're going to spend the money they'd need to do to do that properly. The main problem for those horses, which Temple Grandin pointed out, she did a study back in 1999, that the main problem is the owners of those horses, who, instead of looking after the horses or euthanizing the horses, take them to the auction to get, $50, $100. And then the horses end up ship to Canada or Mexico, which is a long way to travel, before being sorted, which is not great. Although that industry might be kind of partly eliminated because the European Union is putting restrictions on what the Canadian plants can do. So that might actually just eliminate the whole business. And then people will have to deal with these horses and look after them properly. But I don't know. Humans don't really have a good track record of doing that. So it's, yeah, it's a perennial problem. And
one of the interesting dichotomies that I thought you had in your book, which was that how you go from talking about horses as meat and this, you know, this disposal of them by their owners for whatever they could get at auction, and then you then go on to describe the exact opposite, which is the degree to which humans put so much value in horses, and the other end of it, which are these breeders and these show horses, and the amount of money that is spent in places like China, where they're a very valuable commodity, and one at which people will lavish enormous sums to keep in better conditions than many humans.
Yeah. I mean, I knew that. I mean, the topic of horses as status symbols is not new. And when I was thinking about the book, you kind of thought, well, I could go to Palm Beach or Kentucky or, you know, some traditional expensive horse area, you could put it that way. And I wasn't very interested in that. And then I just started to find all these stories about China, which is really fascinating to me because China, obviously because of communism, there has been no kind of luxury horse industry. And so this whole cosmopolitan, global luxury brand conglomerate of polo and horse racing and show jumping and dressage and whatever didn't exist. But now that the economy is opening up and there are a lot of wealthy people there, a lot of entrepreneurs from the West are flooding in and saying to the Chinese, look, you're very rich, but if you want to do being rich properly, you need to be able to ride a very expensive Dutch warm blood, or you need to have a polo team, or you need to own a racehorse, which is complicated because gambling is still not legal on the mainland. So you either have your horse in Hong Kong or it's running in Europe. And because there's also no infrastructure for these horses, you get these kind of extraordinary planned developments that are a bit like, I mean, they have something of the sort of Maoist or communist thing of, you know, let's build the biggest hydroelectric dam in the world in 5 years. They're kind of the horse equivalent of that. They'll be sort of, you know, we're going to build a race course that's also got a farm to grow the food because they don't have food, that's going to have a college to train the vets, that's going to have dormitories for the grooms, that's going to have housing for the wealthy owners, that's going to have a riding school, that's going to have a stud to make the horses. And we're going to build all that in 5 years with gold-plated dishes and etiquette classes. And it was interesting for me to go and observe a little bit of that firsthand. I managed to get to China for all of 9 days, how long I was allowed in, and also to try and look back at the history of the horse in China, which, of course, is, it's very long, but also a great illustration of this catch-22 of horses and money that, when you want to look wealthy or powerful, especially for battle, you need a lot of horses. But keeping a lot of horses standing around costs you a lot of money, and it means you need a lot of land, which traditionally, again, goes with wealth. And the kind of the ways the Chinese have tried to balance that and achieve that with some massive historical financial disasters was pretty interesting to me. But it was also, I sort of realized when I started working actually on writing the chapter, I'd kind of set myself this task of trying to sum up the whole of Chinese history. Began to regret that, not that far into the project, because it's just extraordinary. You know, it's, you think you must be about up to the Tudor period or something, and you're about at around, you know, 100 AD, and just sort of plodding through the emperors. But I loved it, and I found it really fascinating.
And I really liked it because it, going back to your earlier chapter about the representation of horses in the West with their association with nobility and monarchy, it highlights the degree to which the embracing of horses as status symbols by elites really is not a product of any one society or country, but really does seem to be a universal practice among humans wherever there are horses. That there always is this desire to have breeds that are handsome, to show them off, and it becomes a very prominent symbol of their power and their wealth and their taste.
Yeah, and there was towards the end of writing the book, an archaeologist in Oxford called Peter Mitchell brought out a book called Horse Nations, which is Horse Nations is about the impact of horses on societies after 1492. So it's a kind of a deep dive into what happened when the horse arrived in different Native American societies, in South America, in Australia, in Southern Africa.
Which should be clear, is the book that people who should buy after they buy your book.
You can do, but it's a more detailed account. But I mean, one of the things that shows up is that, you know, inequality quite often follows horses, was what I was sort of working around to say. And I think if I'd known more about that book, I would have incorporated a bit more of that into my book, but it's quite telling. And, you know, that goes right back to, I think is it Aristotle or Plato writes something about, you know, that you require an aristocracy to have cavalry, and that you can't, it's incompatible with democracy, I think, which many would probably concur with.
And that really has continued to the present day, even in places where you don't have the traditional titled aristocracies, nonetheless, that association of horses and wealth remains.
Yeah, there's, I mean, what I also tried to do in both books is point out that there was and there is still like massive, like working class and sort of peasant and farming relationship too. It's just harder to get the written materials. You know, I can find scores of beautiful sort of royal or aristocratic accounts of training your horse from the 1300s onwards. It's harder to find histories and accounts and knowledge of the people who actually groomed these horses or who worked with them. But it's still there. I tried to bring as much of it as I could into the book. And there's still, I mean, horse ownership is more diverse than you think. There are clubs in inner cities. There are people who keep horses on in the equivalent of housing projects. There are, you know, the sort of ideas, people who are sort of outside of traditional society, like travelers and Roma, keep horses. And there's, I always fascinated in inner city riding clubs and groups that still persist. Sometimes they're even in basically what were the old working horse stables, although fewer of those have survived in London now. But I think it's, you know, one of the things that makes the horse interesting is that it's, when, you know, you try and come up with grand historical theories about horses, it usually comes astray because on the one hand, they do have this association, very strong one, with power and aristocracy and inequality. But on the other hand, they're also the sort of basic labor units still in parts of the world. And, you know, like I said, the sort of scrap animals that are broken up to parts or meat. You know, the number of things we managed to turn horses' bodies into is kind of quite gross and extraordinary in itself. So it's, they just cover such a range that it's hard to sort of bring it down to one line, I think.
Well, I thought you did a really good job of encapsulating so much of that relationship with horses in your final chapter about their role as a tool of war. Because with that chapter, you were not just describing how they were employed, but you also get into how horses respond to being in this environment, which is perhaps the most alien environment that horses are exposed to, and how humans not only adapted them, but how horses were shaped by it. I was struck in particular by the anecdote you describe of the British Army veteran after the Battle of Waterloo, who purchased horses, who also were veterans of the battle, and who described how, you know, even in the English countryside, years afterward, they would still daily, almost like clockwork, go through this particular routine that was connected to the training that they had received as instruments of war.
Yeah, and I think that anecdote is really fascinating because basically it was a piece of training done by humans for war that happened to be something that horses like doing, which, you know, outside of the battlefield and without bullets whizzing around, horses like to do things together in, you know, a degree of synchrony, and they like to run together. So what they'd been trained to do was line up and charge, and that is what they carried on doing, you know, long after the war, even when they're at liberty. And it obviously gave them a degree of pleasure to do it. I don't think they were just doing it, you know, in a kind of Pavlovian sort of reaction. You know, there was no bugle setting them off. They just knew they liked to do that, and so they did it. And that's one of the reasons, I think, although, you know, this is a question I ended up asking myself, is we talk constantly about horses as today as, you know, flight animals and prey and scared of everything. And then you think, well, hang on, why did we spend thousands of years, and we still are actually taking them directly into battle? You know, people tried to do that with elephants. That didn't work hugely well. They tried to do that with pigs. The Chinese may have tried to do it with sheep. We're not sure. These things didn't work. Horses did. And I think it was, that was what I was trying to get into in that chapter, is how on earth, as it were, horses' motives came together with human motives and somehow produced this outcome. Although also not always, because quite often the horses just were running on fear and adrenaline, quite obviously. And when you look at the spurs that were being used on them and the bridles, the bits, it's, you know, it's quite obvious that the riders were aiming on having control and fear to some extent on their side. So,
and yet, how is that different from how so many people react in war? Because I was thinking as I was reading about that a lot of that can be applied to, you know, humans, that humans, you read all these accounts of how they experience a lot of the same things. And it strikes me as the degree to which there really isn't as much of a separation, is there, between how horses respond to war and how they have to be trained for it. You describe how the process by which they would be acclimated to gunfire, and then also acclimated to shell fire, to the point where eventually they adapted, much as humans often did. But it often took that same, you know, overcoming the fear and coping with the adrenaline of being in an environment that really is not entirely natural for either species.
Yeah, and there's lots of historical accounts of horses seeming to enjoy war, which is also true of, you know, some humans. You know, I guess it's like a sheer adrenaline and the focus of the moment that does that. And of course, yeah, if you look at a lot of most human military training is about getting humans to do things together, to sort of to march in synchrony, to think about other people in the group, to look out for other people in the group, which is, of course, you know, which is, of course, exactly what horses are naturally doing. You know, that's their survival mode. So I don't know. I guess we're all mammals. You know, we like to be in groups. We habituate pretty well to things, and we get scared. Yeah.
Well, we've taken up a lot of your time, but before we go, could you tell us what you're working on now?
At the moment, I've kind of been doing. I find it very hard to research less. I've been trying to do shorter articles that sort of tie in with some of the extra material I have, but they then keep spiraling out of control. I've got an essay I've done on the Palio, which is a medieval horse race that's still run in Siena in Italy, which is just the most fantastically complicated and extraordinary civic exercise. It's about corruption. It's about open bribery. It's about the cosmos to some extent. It's sort of man against fate. And it all comes down to these horses running around a square, a tiny square in the middle of Siena three times, twice a year. And I'm also trying to track down the real identity of a woman. Her photo went viral in something like 2012, and I put it on my blog. And someone's actually making a short film inspired by the photo of her. And I've decided to try and work out who she is, and I've been working on that on and off. She was photographed in 1891 in Paris. She is dressed, and the photo is labeled that she's what was known as an écuyère, which is a woman dressage rider who performed very high-level dressage in the circus. So it's a very high-status job. And there are a lot of these women, they were famous. And the unusual thing about this woman in particular is that she's black. And if you think at that time in history, black people were on display in France in kind of human zoos. And then there's this extraordinary image of this beautiful, absolutely defiant woman in a immaculate riding habit. And I'm just trying to find out who on earth she is. And her name is Jelika Lazevsky, except that maybe it's not. And I'm chasing through all kinds of archives and finding missing files and just desperately trying to work out who she is. So I have a feeling the essay is going to be about trying to find her rather than actually finding her, because she seems to have disappeared without a trace. There's just these photographs from this very famous studio, and that's it.
It sounds like a very engrossing project.
It is. And I've just received a new book in the post that I've got to comb through and see if I can desperately find any extra clues.
Well, Susanna Forrest, thank you for taking some time out of your schedule today to speak with us. I hope you have a wonderful day.
Thank you so much. It's been great.